Good evening. Welcome to the Spring 2017 Green Living Seminar Series at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. My name is Dan Shustak, your host for this spring seminar series. This annual lecture series is funded by MCLA's Academic Affairs, the Environmental Studies Department, and donors to the MCLA Foundation. Each spring semester, we invite a series of experts to campus to present on various aspects of sustainability and the environment. This semester, our series topic is the science and management of invasive species. Over the course of the semester, we will welcome to MCLA various experts from state and federal agencies, academia, nonprofits, and private industry. Each week, our guest speaker will delve into their area of expertise related to the research and management of invasive species in our state, region, as well as globally. Information and links to audio and video recordings of tonight's lecture will be posted at mcla.edu/greenliving. Tonight's presentation will last around 45 minutes, and then we'll have some time for questions and answers at the end. Tonight's speaker is Brendan Quarian. Brendan began working on invasive species issues in the Adirondacks in 2008, when he worked as a summer intern mapping roadways for invasive plant infestations for the New York State Department of Transportation. Brendan joined the Adirondack Park Invasive Plant Program, housed under the Nature Conservancy, in 2010 as the Terrestrial Invasive Species Project Coordinator. He was promoted to the Program Manager in September 2014 and now coordinates regional invasive species action and fosters innovative solutions to invasive species spread. Brendan received a Bachelor's of Technology in Wildlife Management from the State University of New York at Cobleskill. Please help me welcome Brendan to MCLA.
Thanks, Dan. Well, thanks for having me tonight. I'm really excited to present to you on invasive species and more specifically about our program, the Adirondack Park Invasive Plant Program, which I manage, and the partnerships that we've established over the years, because that is really the core of our work, and it's how we've been able to leverage invasive species management and prevention success over the years. So to start out, I just want to give you a quick overview of what APIP is, who we are, and what we do. We're the Adirondack Park Invasive Plant Program, and we're one of eight partnerships for regional invasive species management in New York. So this is us up here. We were founded in 1998, and we're one of those eight prisms across the state. And our mission is to protect the Adirondack region from the negative impacts of non-native invasive species. We have three goals: one, to prevent new introductions of invasive species to the region; two, to rapidly detect and respond to infestations; and three, to manage existing priority infestations to mitigate their impacts. And we're funded through the New York State Environmental Protection Fund. As I mentioned, APIP is at our core is a partnership program. We were founded by three state agencies: the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, the New York State Department of Transportation, the Adirondack Park Agency, and then the fourth is the Nature Conservancy, which isn't a state agency. It's a not-for-profit, one of the largest not-for-profits in the world. So it's kind of a unique structure in that we are kind of a pseudo or semi-state agency, but we're also housed underneath a not-for-profit. And the benefit of that is we can act like a state agency. We can, you know, if we find an infestation, we have authority to go in and manage it on the state lands. But we can also sidestep government bureaucracy, so that we can actually respond quickly to infestations when it warrants it. And alongside us are over 30 different partners, ranging from academic institutions to environmental advocacy groups to lake associations. It really runs the gamut. And this is where our strength lies. This is where we can, you know, leverage these partnerships to really achieve great invasive species management success in our region. And that's what I'm going to be focusing on today. So you'll hear me reference many of these partnerships throughout my presentation. So you might ask, why does New York care so much about invasive species as opposed to many other states that don't have, you know, complete invasive species management coverage, you know, may not even fully understand what the invasive species threat is or are willing to address it? And I think the best demonstration of that, or of why New York is so committed, is this map. This is a map put together in 2013 by Andrew Liebold and a group of researchers that looked at forest pests by county across the United States. And you'll notice that there's something unique about New York. We have the highest number of forest pests of any state in the country. And this is just forest pests. It's not pests. It's not considering aquatic invasive species. It's not considering terrestrial invasive plants. If this were to also show aquatic invasive species, it would show a very similar result. Terrestrial invasive plants are usually more consolidated down into the southeastern portion of the United States. But what this means for us, really, is that New York is ground zero for the introduction and spread of invasive species into the rest of the United States. So we kind of have an obligation to do our due diligence and try and make sure that they aren't introduced so that we benefit the rest of the country or the rest of the country is protected. So again, New York really has a critical role to play in protecting the United States. So many of you have probably already been to one of these seminars in the past. You may already know what an invasive species is from your studies. I heard a lot of you are in environmental studies, which is great. To avoid the curse of knowledge, I want to make sure everyone knows what invasive species is before I go into too much detail on this. So first off, I want to tell you what they're not. So first off, they're not a native species. A native species is technically one that's been here, always been here. Prior to European settlement is the definition that most people use. So a good example is the white trillium. It's been here for a long time. Hopefully it will continue to be here. Then we have non-native species. These are species either accidentally or purposely moved outside of their historic range. So a good example is the California poppy. Obviously it's from California. It's not from New York. But it was brought here. Probably intentionally, because it's an ornamental plant, and it's kind of minding its own business. It's not causing harm in any capacity, so it's just a non-native. We also have nuisance species. These are species that we kind of put our own value judgments on. So you might have dandelions growing in your yard, or you might have deer browsing on the shrubs in your yard. You don't like what they're doing, but they could be native, they could be non-native. You're just saying, I don't like it. You know, they're a pest to my yard or to my life. And that's what a pest or nuisance species is. And then lastly, what I'm going to be focusing on tonight are invasive species or noxious species. These are species that are also non-native. They were brought from somewhere else on the planet, but they're causing significant harm in their new environment. And those harms can be ecological, economic, or societal. And I'm going to be touching on those quickly just to demonstrate some of the impacts these species can have. So environmental impacts. I'm going to talk about just four species that maybe you have heard about. I'm assuming at least some of these you have. And talk about the impacts that they're having in the areas that they're currently invading. So first off, zebra mussels and quagga mussels. Who here has heard of zebra mussels or quagga mussels? Okay, great. So they're an invasive mollusk. They were brought in through ballast water discharge in the St. Lawrence and the Great Lakes. And they're invading the Great Lakes right now. They're also in Lake Champlain in my neck of the woods. And what they're doing is they're just proliferating to such massive extent that this beach here is about 14 inches of just zebra mussel or quagga mussel shells. There are some that believe that if you drained the Great Lakes, you could walk across the entire bottom without touching sand. You could just walk on shells of zebra mussels or quagga mussels. Pretty amazing that they can do that. And you can imagine the impact that is having on the ecosystem. Imagine that many mollusks filtering the water, filtering all the phytoplankton, zooplankton, and the cascading effects up the food chain as a result of that. Next is water chestnut. Who's heard of water chestnut? Okay, even more. This is another aquatic invasive plant. And as you can see here, it smothers waterways, essentially covering the surface of the water within a certain depth. And underneath that mat of vegetation, it can be darker than night. Very low oxygen levels, very low productivity as a result of that. You can also imagine the recreational impacts or economic impacts that result from this. Phragmites, one of my favorites, one of the ones that I like controlling the most. This is probably the worst wetland invader in the world. The largest infestation that we know of is in New Jersey. It's about 5,000 acres in size. It's a large perennial grass that grows about 12, 15 feet tall with this large tassel. I'm sure pretty much everyone in here has seen this, whether you realize it or not. It's very common across the Northeast. Not widespread yet in the Adirondacks, and I'll talk about some of the control work we're doing on it there, but a very aggressive plant. And a pest, hemlock woolly adelgid. Do you guys have hemlock woolly adelgid here yet? Well, if you don't yet, you will eventually. It's on its way. It's one that we're very worried about in the Adirondacks. This is a picture from the Smokies, where it essentially is extirpated, eastern hemlock, from those forests. And the Adirondacks has the highest density of hemlock of anywhere in New York State. So we're extremely concerned about this moving north. And this is one that is being exacerbated by climate change. Cold winters were limiting its spread up until recently, and now it's moving further and further north because of climate change. So moving on to economic impacts. This picture should, maybe is familiar to some of you. How far is Worcester away from here? Worcester, Massachusetts. 2 hours? Okay, so maybe not. Has anybody been to Worcester recently? Okay. So this is a picture of Worcester prior to Asian longhorn beetle. And as a result of Asian longhorn beetle, this is what happened. That same street had all of the hardwood trees cut down. And you can imagine the costs to the municipality in having to remove all those trees, as well as the cost to homeowners. They no longer have shade value. They no longer have aesthetic value. And a lot of them had to pay for that tree removal on their own instead of relying on the town to do it. For aquatic invasives, they can often, as I mentioned earlier with water chestnut, they reduce the property values and visitor spending in a region. So if you own this home here and you can't necessarily access the lake well, you can't swim off your beach, your property value goes way down. Similarly, if you have a public body of water and it has, you know, dense beds of aquatic vegetation in it, people aren't going to come and use it. They're not going to want to come and boat and fish and swim in it. So clean lakes are really important to a local economy, especially in the Adirondacks. Reduced crop production. So this is an example of what Eurasian borer can do if they get into a cornfield. We had an infestation show up in 2010 in a farm in the Champlain Valley, and just within a matter of weeks, they already caused $20,000 worth of damage on that farm. Luckily, they're eradicated now, but for many other states, there's no eradication story, and they're dealing with economic agricultural impacts in the millions of dollars every year as a result. And then increased construction costs and maintenance. So this is a picture of Japanese knotweed. Grows so aggressively, it can come right up through new pavement and roads, right through a foundation of a house. If you have a construction project and you decide not to control the knotweed ahead of time, you're going to be dealing with it after the fact, after you're done, and you're going to be spending a lot of money trying to deal with it. In the UK, they found that just the presence of this species on a construction site increased the cost of about 10% for the entire project. So these are, you know, big numbers. Moving on to human health impacts. So this is a tree-lined street that has been impacted by emerald ash borer. These are all dead or dying ash trees along this sidewalk. For one, you know, ash trees tend to break apart easily. You can imagine if that individual was walking under there under, you know, some snow, one of those branches could fall off, and that could pose a problem. But interestingly, there's a study by Donovan in a medical journal that showed that cities that were impacted by emerald ash borer had increased rates of lower respiratory illness and cardiovascular disease. And they were able to link that those cities that were being impacted actually had increased deaths as a result. See, we don't always understand the value that trees can have on our health. They're just filtering the air and making sure that we, you know, aren't breathing all the toxic substances that are in the air prior to them filtering it out. And then blocked signage and lines of sight. This is one that we commonly do within the Adirondacks for knotweed species and Phragmites. These species can grow so tall that they can actually block signage and lines of sight. So if you're coming around an intersection and you have Phragmites or knotweed on either side, if you can't see your line of sight, there's the potential that you could have an increase or a chance of accident as a result. Tick-borne diseases. I know this is becoming a hot topic in Massachusetts, especially down on the Cape, Martha's Vineyard. So many of the terrestrial invasive plants that we control actually improve tick habitat. There was a study that showed that the presence of Japanese barberry increased tick populations by a matter of 100% in some instances. So If we don't control many of these terrestrial invasive plants, ticks can actually be more prevalent and spread tick-borne diseases like Lyme disease. And then burns and rashes. There are two different plants that we deal with that can create burns or cause burns this severe. So this is a picture of a DEC coworker that actually walked through some giant hogweed accidentally. And the burn that resulted on her skin, you can see, you know, 5 days in, she's got some severe blistering. Even 5 months after that exposure, she has a permanent scar on her leg. We had 16 infestations of giant hogweed that we've managed in the Adirondacks. All of them are on their way to being eradicated, but we have to wear full hazmat suits when we go in and address this plant. So implications for the Adirondacks. Who has been to the Adirondacks before? Okay, not too many. For those of you that haven't, I highly encourage you to at some point. For those of you that have, you know how special a landscape it is. It is extremely large, and it is one of the last forest types of its kind within the entire planet. It's the last of three that are this large and intact on the entire globe. Just want to give a general summary of the Adirondacks. So I mentioned it's large. Anybody have a sense of how big the Adirondack Park is? No? So the Adirondack Park alone is 6 million acres. Our boundary extends up to the border with Canada. So we're at about 7.2 million acres. To put that in perspective, the park alone is larger than five other national parks combined. They could fit inside the borders. We're almost to the size of Vermont. The national parks that can fit within our borders are Yosemite, Yellowstone, Glacier, the Grand Canyon, and the Smokies, Smoky National Park. So big national parks. We're also very remote. Out of all of that land area, we only have about 1,700 miles of state roads. Hardly anything. This particular stretch around the High Peaks region can take 2 hours just to try and get around. And most of it, you just can't put roads through some of these areas. They're just too rugged. We're also primarily protected. So within the Adirondack Park, almost half of our land area is state land. Forever wild, protected land. And it's open to the public. Anybody can go and hike these lands, recreate on them. And it's a really great resource for that. We also have a lot of water. We have 3,000 lakes and ponds, nearly 30,000 miles of rivers and streams, and 600,000 acres of wetlands. But most importantly, we have people. This is what separates us. This is why we are different from a national park. We have people living inside our park boundaries. We have over 100 towns and villages, small towns and villages, and these people are living here, recreating here, working here, and trying to make a living across this landscape. So you might ask, what does this have to do with invasive species? Well, I want to show you this map. So we've been mapping terrestrial invasive plant infestations across the landscape since our founding. And what you'll notice is they seem to follow these really clearly defined road or linear paths. Those are roads. They follow human disturbance, primarily. It is very rare that we find infestations way back in on the forest preserve. We do every once in a while. But for the most part, invasive species follow where people have tread. Similarly, for our aquatic invasive species distribution, the lakes that have invasive species in them currently usually have motorized access. They're close to a road. They're not remote. You'll notice these smaller lakes that are way back in, they're surveyed and usually nothing is there. So aquatic invasive species also follow human footprints. So the case for action in the Adirondacks. Obviously we have threats encroaching on the park, but we have a tremendous resource to protect. Overall, excluding Lake Champlain, only 12 aquatic invasive species have been found in the region. And based on our surveys, 2 out of every 3 lakes that we survey is still free of aquatic invasives. For the terrestrial side of things, a newly detected terrestrial invasive plant infestation is usually under 0.1 acres in size. To put that in perspective, that's smaller than this room, usually. And infestations are most commonly associated with human disturbance, as I mentioned. And they haven't invaded the interior forest. For forest pests, we do have the historic invaders that came through and wiped out tree species like the American chestnut and elm. But as far as these new and emerging threats like emerald ash borer, Asian longhorn beetle, and hemlock woolly adelgid, they're not there yet. They're on their way. You know, they're slowly encroaching, but they haven't been identified within the Adirondacks yet. The question is, what is being done? And this is where I'm really going to get into what our program is doing to address invasive species threats throughout the Adirondacks. So first and foremost, awareness. If people are the problem or part of the problem, then awareness is part of the solution. You can't just go in and manage invasive species and not address what's introducing them in the first place. So we really focused a lot on this. This was a billboard that we had up on the Northway, which is the only highway that comes into the Adirondacks, just last year, just reinforcing the clean, drain, dry messaging to prevent the spread of aquatic invasive species. And with this billboard, we anticipate we reach nearly 6 million people just through drive-by impressions. More recently, just last week, we released the first in a series of videos that cover the invasive species threat in New York. And I actually want to play this real quickly for you. It's only a couple minutes long. Can everybody see that okay?
Around the world, invasive plants, animals, and insects are causing new problems for nature and people at a dangerous pace. New York State, with its extensive trade connections, is the main gateway for new invaders to arrive on the doorstep of the United States. The introduction and spread of invasive species demands urgent and strategic action. Knotweed degrades stream corridors and can reduce property values. Phragmites overtakes wetlands and can increase road maintenance costs. Emerald ash borer is wiping out the trees used to produce Major League Baseball bats. Water chestnut smothers waterways and can block boating and fishing. New invaders are on their way. Changing temperatures and precipitation patterns will exacerbate their impacts. What can you do? Use local firewood for camping or heating. Clean, drain, and dry all fishing and boating gear between trips. Use clean fill and native plants for construction or landscaping projects. Clean dirt from your boots and gear after hiking to avoid spreading seeds. By taking these preventive actions and responding quickly to new infestations, we can all do our part to protect our forests, clean water, and communities for future generations. To learn more, visit adkinvasives.com.
So we're going to have three other videos coming out over the course of the year that go into more detail on the invasive species threat and what anyone can do to prevent the spread. The voiceover for that was actually Mike Richter, someone you wouldn't expect to be a voiceover for a conservation video. He was the goaltender for the New York Rangers World Cup team. And we're really tying it to defending New York from invasive species. So that's why we picked him to do that. So in tandem with that, we're really doing a lot of education and training surrounding invasive species. And we hold a series of training events throughout the course of the summer. For those of you that do come to the Adirondacks, I would highly encourage you to become one of our volunteers. Come to one of our trainings and learn how you can support our work. So this is a picture up on the left-hand side of one of our aquatic invasive plant trainings where we actually train people to survey for aquatic invasive species when they're out paddling an Adirondack lake. This is how we've generated all of the data for that distribution map that I showed you earlier, which represents about 15 years of data. And so far, this past year, we reached over 1,800 people through these training events and presentations alone. This is another one on the terrestrial side of things. We actually trained New York State DOT and Highway Department staff to identify terrestrial invasive plants growing along the roadway. You noticed earlier that a lot of our infestations are along the roadway. Many of them are actually spread through improper road maintenance techniques, whether it be mowing through infestations that auto-fragment. You know, Japanese knotweed and Phragmites can spread through fragmentation, so if you mow through an infestation, essentially you're just spreading the species further down the road. Or through ditching activities, moving fill from one place to another can also spread terrestrial invasive plants. So we're trying to target the audience that we really need to assist us in mitigating the impacts of invasive species across the park. And since 2009, we've reached over 13,500 people through these events. Prevention. At the tail end of that video that we just watched, you heard three different prevention messages that I'll reinforce here. The first being clean, drain, dry. We really emphasize that you need to be doing this every time you come out of a water body and before you go into another one. If you're going into the same water body, it's not that big a deal. But if you're going somewhere else each time, you really need to take these steps to prevent the spread of aquatic invasive species. And we actually have, through some of our partners, the Paul Smith College Adirondack Watershed Institute and New York State DEC, have established the first program of its kind east of the Mississippi River that actually advances boat decontamination stations or boat wash stations. And that's what you can see in this picture here. So in addition to the number of inspections that we perform at boat launches, people can now actually take their boat and trailer to one of these wash stations before going into a water body, have it completely decontaminated, and then they're free and clear to go wherever they want after that. And through that project, just in the past 2 years, we've intercepted over 1,700 aquatic invasive species through those inspections and through those decontaminations. So a tremendous number of invasives have been stopped before they enter our waters. For the terrestrial invasive plant side of things, we really promote know before you grow. This is an initiative we advanced with our partner, the Adirondack Garden Club, really promoting the use of native plants in gardening and landscaping. Non-natives are okay too, but we really emphasize the importance of natives because they are a contributing member to the ecosystem. Non-natives are there. They're not causing harm, but they're not benefiting anything either. So native plants are really the way to go for gardening and landscaping, and also promoting the use of clean fill. As I mentioned, fill and mowing through infestations can spread species worse, or the spread in terrestrial invasive plants. So we really need to make sure that we're using clean sources of fill. And lastly, I'm sure many of you have heard, don't move firewood. This is relating to forest pests like Asian longhorn beetle and emerald ash borer. They're often spread in firewood that people use or bring from their home state when they go camping, because the true pest is actually the larval stage of the insect. It's not the adult. It's the larval stage of the insects that are killing the trees. They're girdling the inside of the tree, chewing on the inside of the tree, and killing it. So if you harvest that tree and bring that somewhere else, it'll continue to cause damage inside that log, will eventually emerge, be an adult, will reproduce, and you'll have a reoccurring problem in that new location. So buy local firewood. Use local firewood whenever it's available. It's not going to be harboring something that you don't want it to be. This is my wife and I dressed up as an Asian longhorn beetle and an emerald ash borer in our winter carnival parade, just promoting invasive species awareness and don't move firewood. So early detection. I mentioned our volunteer network that assists with detecting aquatic invasive species throughout the park. So we train hundreds of volunteers each year to be on the lookout for aquatic invasive species when they're out paddling or boating. And they get to select which water bodies they want to go paddle on. They usually just say, I'm going to be on vacation. I'm going to be on St. Regis Lake. I'm going to pick that one, and I'll just look while I'm out enjoying the lake. And we have nearly 700 volunteers now assisting us with aggregating data on aquatic invasive species distribution throughout the park. More recently, we established a new program with the Adirondack Mountain Club, another one of our partners, to survey for both aquatic invasive species and terrestrial invasive pests in the backcountry. So these are areas where people don't frequent as often, but we still are curious if there are invasive species there. For the most part, we found that they're not. As I mentioned earlier, they're really closely tied with human disturbance, but it's good to know that they're not there. because it helps us prioritize our efforts and make sure that they don't impede into the forest. And rapid response. So we have two rapid response teams that we work with every summer. We have a terrestrial response team that comes in from Tennessee. It's a company called Invasive Plant Control that we contract out with. And they're out there every day managing terrestrial invasive plant infestations on the ground for us. And to date, we started in 2011. That team has managed over 2,000 infestations of our priority invasive plants. And 340 of those historically managed infestations currently have no plants present. So essentially eradicated. We don't claim eradication until 3 consecutive years of no plants observed, but a lot of infestations are becoming eradicated over time. And similarly with the aquatic response team, this is our partner on the Paul Smith College Adirondack Watershed Institute. They've surveyed, so we just started this 2 years ago, so they don't have as much tenure, but they've surveyed 76 lakes for aquatic invasive species since 2015, and only 3 have been newly documented as invaded. So pretty exciting news there for us and potential or opportunity for us to prevent the spread as a result of this work. So I know that's a lot of numbers. I want to show you what this means on the ground. I think it's better to understand by looking at pictures or visuals how this impacts ecosystems in the Adirondacks. So this is a story of an infestation we called Lower Cherry Patch. It's a Phragmites infestation. It's this kind of light green plant material here in the center of the picture. So we knew that this infestation existed way back in 2003. At that particular time, we could not manage it. We could manage it, but we could only cut it. We couldn't do anything else. It was on the nearest state forest preserve. We couldn't do any herbicide treatments, anything aggressive. So we tried to go in there and do everything we could to knock it back. We went in and cut. We went in and bagged up the material. We went multiple times a year, and this is what happened. That infestation just exploded to the point where nearly the entire front end of that wetland had been taken over and was spreading much farther back towards these hills here. What you don't see in this picture, this wetland actually extends back to the Aust-Sable River and is almost a 20-acre wetland complex. So slowly over time, it was taking over that entire wetland system. In 2010, we got permission to perform the first herbicide treatment on the forest preserve ever. And we decided that this infestation warranted trying to do something, since we had tried all other options and we weren't being successful. So in 2010, we did the first selective herbicide treatment of this infestation, and we followed up with that every year. And I want to show you what has happened to the site as a result. So here's 2010. So I only have pictures through 2013, but you can see you wouldn't be able to tell that Phragmites was ever there based on these photos. We have native plants starting to recolonize. I'm not going to lie, there still is a little bit of Phragmites here. It was a fairly large site when we started managing it, but you can see the benefit of the work. The good news is that's not the only site where this is happening. These are all of the infestations, Phragmites infestations, that we've managed in the interior of the Adirondacks since 2010. And I want to walk you through this graph because I know it's a little complicated to understand. So the red bars indicate any new sites that are documented in a given year. Orange is initial treatments performed. Yellow is when we do a follow-up treatment. And then the green, blue, and purple bars are when an infestation advances to having no plants observed for 1, 2, or 3 years. When it reaches 3, we say it's been eradicated. So ideally, if we were being successful in our control efforts, we would want to see reductions in the red, orange, and yellow bars and increases in the green, blue, and purple bars. And for the most part, that's what we're seeing. Slowly over time, we're getting more sites to advance to having no plants observed. And as of last year, over 50% of the sites that we've managed inside the Adirondacks are now in their at least 1 year of no plants observed, and over 100 have been eradicated from the landscape. So it's pretty exciting. We're in the process of publishing this work right now. It'll be hopefully out in the journal Biological Invasion sometime this coming year. So we're really excited to share the results of this. And that kind of leads into the research side of our work. So we collaborate with numerous universities to publish the results of some of our management and prevention efforts. So this is the one I just mentioned. It's not out yet. It's currently under review. But it's called Management of Invasive Phragmites Australis in the Adirondacks, A Cautionary Tale About Prospects of Eradication. And essentially what we were able to show is that size mattered. I mean, that's the only thing I could come up with. So small infestations, extremely small infestations, had the highest probability of being eradicated, nearly 83% success rate. As the infestations got larger, over 3,000 liters squared, it was 1% or less. So early detection rapid response matters. You have to find these infestations small in order to be able to eradicate them from the landscape. If they're beyond a certain size threshold, you're not going to be able to eradicate them. You can have long-term suppression or containment, like that lower cherry patch infestation that I showed you, but you're not going to remove it from the landscape completely. Your hope there is biological control. If you can have a biological control agent to release on an invasive species infestation, that will also result in long-term containment. Another one that we're working on, that just got published, is this predictive model for aquatic invasive species in the Adirondacks. So it's called Predicting Aquatic Invasion in Adirondack Lakes, a spatial analysis of lake and landscape characteristics. And we worked on this with Ryerson University, and it's published in the journal Ecosphere. And what we were able to do is compile all that data that our volunteers have been collecting over the past 15 years and see exactly what kinds and types of lakes are most vulnerable to invasion based on landscape characteristics and land use. And what we found is that deep, cold, high elevation lakes are not vulnerable to aquatic invasion. The opposite end of the spectrum are lakes that are highly developed, have a lot of urban infrastructure surrounding them, are close to main roads like the Northway. Those are. And these red lakes on the map are invasion hotspots that we identify. These are areas where we know there's a high likelihood for invasives to show up, and we can now prioritize our prevention efforts. We also found one cold spot, interestingly, where there doesn't seem to be much risk to invasion for these lakes. Another one just published last year, Assessing Feasibility in Invasive Plant Management, a Retrospective Analysis of Garlic Mustard Control. I know this presentation is a lot about success stories, but I'm not going to lie. We've had failures, too, and we've actually been able to use those failures for a benefit. So this was a situation where we started managing a garlic mustard infestation, weren't getting the results that we wanted, and it turns out that if we had utilized a pre-project planning tool, like the Invasive Plant Management Decision Analysis tool, before we implemented that project, it probably would have told us not to do it. At the time when we started managing it, we didn't have tools like this. It was back in, I think, 2008. We didn't have tools to help us set, you know, realistic priorities or objectives for our control work. And as a result, we engaged in a project that ultimately wasn't successful. So we're really promoting the use of pre-project planning tools to make sure that you're setting yourself up for success when you control any invasive plant infestation. And innovation. This is the most exciting part of my presentation, I think. Or I'm most excited about. So we're utilizing new technologies for invasive species prevention and management, including UAVs. We're initiating for the first time this year a UAV monitoring program for invasive plants. So this is a map demonstrating the difference in imagery that you can achieve from a UAV as opposed to, you know, standard satellite imagery. So the dark outline is standard satellite imagery, and then the lighter is what we've collected with our UAV. And I will actually say this was at a pretty high level. I think we were at about 200 feet with our UAV. Obviously, the closer you are to the ground, the higher the resolution photo you'll get. But what we were able to do here, you might notice that some of these vegetation types in here kind of stick out differently. Those are actually Phragmites infestations that we were able to map utilizing a drone. And the benefit of drones is you can actually swap out filters or different sensors to, you know, really hone in on these infestations. This is another one that shows elevation. And you can see these Phragmites patches actually look concave. You know, they really stick out even more. So you can overlap these different sensor images and really know exactly where these infestations are on the ground. To put this in perspective, these infestations are about I think under a tenth of an acre in size each. For standard remote sensing of Phragmites, you have to have an infestation of at least 2.5 acres. At that point, it's too late. Eradication is no longer an option. But if we can find infestations while they're still small, we have a chance to eradicate them. I went in this wetland back in 2013, and it took me almost a full day to map all these infestations. And that's in 20 minutes, we were able to put this drone up, fly the entire thing with transects, and get a very accurate sense of the size of these infestations. So it's amazing, you know, the level of accuracy and detail and efficiency that results from utilizing some of these technologies. Same thing for aquatics. We're also pursuing unmanned aquatic vehicles for detection of invasive plants and animals and lake mapping. There's a company called Platypus that actually develops these small completely autonomous mapping boats. And they will actually, you know, swim transects and map the lake bed for you, or map vegetation beds, and they're using a program called BioBase. So it will actually map bathymetry, bottom hardness, and vegetation. So you know exactly if there's vegetation in the lake at all. You can actually see where the beds are, then go back and tell what actually is there. So we're actually going to have this deployed for the first time this coming summer, and we're really excited about this as well. And then lastly, we just wrapped up a project mapping hemlocks throughout the Adirondacks. As I mentioned earlier, hemlock woolly adelgid is on its way, and we have the highest density of hemlocks of anywhere in New York State. There's been a projection that and this is what it looks like, by 2027, this area of the Adirondacks here will have hemlocks present, and the yellow and red areas will have 10 to 25% mortality or over 25% mortality. So we're talking about in the next decade here, we could have significant impacts. So what we did is we worked with NASA to map hemlock resources throughout the Adirondacks so that we could know where to start surveying and monitoring for hemlock woolly adelgid. So if we do find it small, we can perform early detection and rapid response. The results are still out. I think I'm going to be getting an email probably tomorrow on this. But it's another really cool and innovative project we've been able to advance with one of our partners that I didn't expect, NASA and their DEVELOP intern program. So with that, I want to go back to this slide. As I mentioned before, APIP is a partnership program, and my staff is me, two other people, and one seasonal educator. You can imagine how little we would get done if it was just us out there. And we have our own little saying in the office that says, we are only as strong as our partners. So with that, APIP is only as strong as its partners. Will you join us? You don't have to be living in the Adirondacks to help us. You can come and visit. You can come, you know, monitor or volunteer with us to provide data to our program. The college could collaborate with us on a project. We're always looking for new partners, and we'd be happy to have you. So thank you, and I'll open it up for questions. Yep.
What herbicide did you use for the Phragmites? I'm sure it's in that literature that's being reviewed, but we use a lot of herbicides around here. Which ones did you use successfully?
Yeah. So most of the Phragmites infestations that we deal with are in wetland settings. So we have to use products that are approved to use in wetlands. And New York has some of the strictest regulations on pesticide use. So we use two products primarily, one both being glyphosate-based. One is Rodeo, and the other was Aquamaster. We switched over more recently to Roundup Custom, which has replaced Aquamaster. Yep.
When you're concerned about, for instance, the example of hemlock woolly adelgid coming in from the south, are there concerns about species coming in from the north?
Yeah, especially on the aquatic side. So the St. Lawrence for us is a main gateway for aquatic invasives. They usually are brought in through the St. Lawrence, then established in the Great Lakes. But we just heard that there was a potential hit of snakehead in the Oswego River. It was through an eDNA monitoring effort, so it's not a confirmed instance, but that would be the first instance of snakehead anywhere in the northern part of New York. Yep.
For emerald ash borer and the Asian longhorn, do you have a plan in place right now for when they do arrive?
Yeah, so emerald ash borer is certainly going to get to the Adirondacks eventually. It's really slowing the spread at this point. There's no effective control methods for it. So we're trying to buy time for biocontrols to be developed and really emphasizing don't move firewood. And that's really all we can do right now. Luckily, the Adirondacks doesn't have a lot of ash trees. We only have about 5% of our forest is ash. So it's not one of our top threats, but in other places of the state, it certainly is. For Asian longhorn beetle, that's a totally different story. Its potential list of trees that it can affect is over 20 different species, and most of them being hardwood trees, maple, cherry, prominent trees in the Adirondacks. And for that, luckily, anytime it's been found, the federal government has stepped in and really tried to eradicate it, as they did in Worcester and Long Island. They think they've eradicated it from Long Island completely. Hopefully they have. But if that were to show up in the Adirondacks in the Interior Forest Preserve, I'm not sure we could stop it, to be honest. It would, if we found it early enough, maybe, but if it was already in a contiguous forest and spreading, I'm not sure what we could do. It's a scary one.
A process question in terms of what APIP does and how you choose priorities. How does that work in terms of you and your office making priority decisions, or is it coming from partners who then kind of direct you and where you're going to work?
Yeah, that's a good question. We're actually wrapping up a new priority setting process right now. So New York goes through a threat ranking assessment process for each invasive species that's affecting the state. So say for Phragmites, it might score as 100, be a very, very aggressive invasive species. Others score much lower. So we start out with the ones that are most invasive off of that list. Then we actually winnowed it down even more by doing a threat ranking assessment for the PRISM to see how these species would affect our local landscape in the Adirondacks. Then we assess manageability. So some of these species don't have any effective controls, as I mentioned, for emerald ash borer, at least on eradication. Another example is spiny water flea. If it's in a lake, if it shows up in a lake, there's nothing you can do about it once it gets there. So obviously we want to be focusing on the ones that we can effectively manage. So we again assess them based on that lens, trying to winnow down the list even more to those ones that we think we can effectively eradicate. And then lastly, we do a pre-project planning tool for all of our projects. So the decision analysis tool that I mentioned earlier, we run that for every single project we advance beforehand to make sure that we have realistic objectives and a high probability of success before even investing in the project. But that's the process. It takes time. And it's not perfect. Any other questions?
More organizational. You have many partners out there. Who initiates the discussion? Is it you, or do they come to you? You meet in a forum? How do you exchange ideas? How do you formulate a plan? I mean, what is the central talking board to get you to move?
Yeah, so we have two partner meetings every year where we bring in all of our primary partners. All of our founders are at the table, as well as many of the organizations that were underneath that, and we plan. We sit down and discuss what our plans are for the field season, what everybody's going to be doing, and that helps us, make sure that everyone is on the same page. Regarding who initiates a specific project, it can really depend. Sometimes we take the lead and advance a project like our volunteer monitoring program. Other times, it's one of our partners that comes to us and say, hey, I think this is going to be a really cool idea, and we'll fit one of your needs or meet one of your needs. That's what happened with the NASA developed project that we implemented. One of our partners said, hey, I have a colleague that works for NASA, and I know about this intern project where they essentially will give you free time to do remote sensing for a project of environmental concern. And I said, that's great. We have a need for knowing where our hemlock stands are. And it went from there. That's kind of the beauty of it. We can take the lead, or we can also follow when one of our partners has an awesome project in mind. All right. Well, thank you so much.